was so much younger than today.
I never needed
anybody's help in any way.
Everybody, I'm Beattie Cohn-Bredos, and welcome again, my friends, to the Ask Beattie Show. And that is exactly why I am here every Monday afternoon from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And I cannot believe that I have been hosting the Ask Beattie Show here on the Progressive Radio Network. We're going on to 10 years, but I am here to help. And I think there is really nothing special about saying that, oh, well, I don't need to ever reach out and ask for help. We all need help of various different kinds at different times in our lives. And I remember years and years ago when I was a little girl and even an older girl growing up in Winnipeg, Canada, nobody ever talked about counseling or psychiatry. And maybe on occasion, you know, you would hear the term, the concept of marriage counseling. And what I've hoped, if there is nothing else that I have done and that I have communicated to you over all of these years, is that the very, very, very best thing that we can all do is reach out and ask for help when we're finding that our life and our relationships continues to be in a downward spiral. We don't, and this is my favorite coin phrase that I, you know, talk about it over and over and over again, that we do not need to navigate this life, the ups and downs of just day-to-day living on our own. When you look at team sports, and even if you look at, I mean, I'm, of course, a competitive tennis player, and I think about, look at the teams, look at all the people on the tennis players' teams that help them to become the best that they really want to become. I mean, there are physiotherapists, there are therapists, there are trainers, there are coaches, there are people who are monitoring every single point, every single strategy, not only of the players, but of the competitors. So I'm hoping, you know, that there has become much, much, much less of a stigma. And I think we've succeeded. I think we still have a long, long, long way to go, because what I have found is that people tend to wait too long before they reach out and ask for help. And I was just thinking right now, for those of you who actually may be tuning in for the very first time and you're wondering, what is this woman really talking about? You know, who is Beattie Cohn-Bredos? What is the Ask Beattie Show really all about? Well, I should give you a proper introduction. I am a psychotherapist and a sex therapist. And even though I say this every week, I can hardly even believe it, that I have been practicing for over 35 years. It's amazing. When I did my graduate and postgraduate training at McGill University in Montreal, yes, I am Canadian. Yes, I have dual citizenship. And yes, I'm in the United States because I happen to marry an American. But I'm also the author of the groundbreaking book on relationships. And this is also something that I think about a lot. If I had had my book For better, for worse, forever, discover the path to lasting love. When I was beginning, when I was a very young girl and I was beginning my own relationship, serious relationship and dating life, I can tell you one thing, that life would have been a lot smoother, certainly in that arena. So you're probably wondering, so what is her book really all about? Well, it came out a number of years ago. It's been out in several editions. And what I did was that I did research with 450 people in the Boston, Providence, and Connecticut area. I was living in Providence, Rhode Island for a number of years. And what happened, it's so interesting, what happened as a result of the research is that I developed a 10-step formula. And for people who know me, for people who've been listening to the show, you know that I'm a very bottom line kind person. I don't have time for a lot of nonsense and psychobabble. So what this formula does is that it teaches all of us how to assess. And I know that the word assess, when we think about dating and relationships and love, it is not sexy, it is not romantic. However, it's very important. And what my formula does do is that it teaches us all how to assess and evaluate who's right for you and who's wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship. Because when you think about it, if we're really honest with ourselves, we evaluate and we assess and we look at reviews, right? Online all the time. We are constantly wanting to buy the best car, the best computer, the best cell phone. But when we think about relationships, somehow, because it's not sexy and it's not romantic, you know, to be thinking about assessment and evaluation, those kinds of concepts and terms are things that people really don't think about too much. And yet, we need to do this. We need to do a much, much better job. And, you know, you probably are asking yourself, well, why? Why do we need to do this really at all? Well, let's just look at the divorce statistics in this country. We're talking about the divorce rate for first marriages is 48%. The divorce rate, and people are always surprised, you know, when I go through these statistics, the divorce rate for second marriages happens to be 67%. So one would hope, right? Although hope and wishing and dreaming, believe me, it is certainly not enough if we're talking about evaluating and assessing, you know, really who is right for us and who is wrong for us before committing, whether or not you marry or whether or not you are just wanting to live together, but you're looking at your relationship as something that is really special and where there is a real commitment. So for third marriages, again, the wishing and the hoping is not doing it. The divorce rate for third marriages is 74%. And people are surprised, you know, they'll say, okay, we messed up the first time around and maybe even the second. But clearly there is a learning curve here that we are not taking seriously at all. And for me, when I give my Never Make a Mistake in Love Again presentations, I give them in New York, I give them around the country and also in Canada. I mean, I have identified and I have good news. I want to share good news, good evidence-based news that actually works. So what I've done over the years is that I have been very, very clear. I mean, I have treated thousands of people of every sexual orientation and race and socioeconomic status so that I think I know people pretty, pretty well. And what I've found is that there are three things that we need to do if we are never going to make a mistake in love again. And the first thing is that we've got to be in a good place ourselves. We need to deal with our issues, whatever those issues are. Nothing is perfect. We are never going to be perfect. We can't redo our childhood. We can't redo something that's happened even 30 seconds ago. But we do need to be okay. We need to deal with our depression. We need to deal with our early child sexual abuse, which I'm going to be talking about a lot more in the next few minutes on the show today. And, you know, I used to tell my daughter when she was a little girl, and I would say to her, Jordana, the relationship is got to be something that's solid, and that the relationship for all of us needs to be the icing on the cake. And we need to be the cake. We need to be solid. And if we are not in a good place ourselves, it makes it so difficult and at times almost impossible to be able to find and maintain a healthy and loving and wonderful and romantic relationship with anyone. So the first step really needs to start with us, which is why I am so excited. I am so happy to be consulting at East Hampton High School in East Hampton, New York. And this is a high school where they take mental health very, very, very seriously. They have a number of counselors and social workers and psychologists and guidance counselors. And then there is me. I am the consultant. And I've been working with a Mr. Jim Stewart, who unfortunately has retired this year, who I just loved working with, just an absolutely gem of a human being and teacher. And what we've been trying to do is integrate my psychological and clinical background into a lot of the health material, the mental health material that is actually being taught at the school. And I have to tell you, the kids, they're really eating all of this up. They want to learn. They want to learn about healthy relationships. They want to learn about healthy sexuality. They need to have people to talk to. They need to have adults that they can talk to, who they can connect with, and who they feel comfortable with, and who they can trust to be able to go to and talk about, regardless of what it is that's perhaps not going on in their lives. And one of the things that I think as a society that we continue to miss over and over and over again is the importance of acknowledging how early identification of mental health issues and early intervention is absolutely, absolutely key. When you're looking at these kids, the shootings that are going on in schools, if you're looking at murderers, if you're looking at all kinds of chaotic craziness that continually goes on in our society, the people, the perpetrators, they were once little boys and they were once little girls. And research shows that for people, not 100%, of course, but for people who growing up in abusive homes of various different kinds, physical, sexual, emotional, verbal, there are going to be serious, serious scars that are going to be appearing. And we can see these scars at children at a very, very, very young age. You know, after I completed my graduate and postgraduate work at McGill University in Montreal, My first job was in the inner city schools, and I had three schools that I was accountable to be working with the teachers and to be working with the other counselors, psychologists and guidance counselors. And what was so great about that program, and the principals bought in and the superintendents bought in, and there was not an issue. There was not a problem about whether or not Beattie or other school social workers should be involved in a really, really important and I think life-changing program for kids. And we had little kids in kindergarten and in first grades, and the teachers were able to see that something was off. Something was off. We weren't blaming the child. We were not blaming the parents, but every single kid where there were concerns, the teachers were able to make referrals so that little kids who were 5 and 6 would come to my office and we would talk. And I would then be able to meet with the parents. And I remember in those days, I would be making a lot of home visits and seeing where the children lived in their own little world. And it was a wonderful program. And after 3 years of being on the front line, I became one of 3 directors of the Greater Montreal School Social Services Program. And it's not such a difficult thing to do. And people will say, well, we don't have the money. Well, do we have the money to be keeping people in prison for years and years and years when the people in prison were so many of the people in prison, the so-called violent criminals? They were once little kids, and the majority, and the research is very, very, very clear that these little boys and little girls who grew up to be violent and who grew up to do terrible, terrible things, for the most part, they came from families where terrible, terrible things were done to them. So my mission, of course, is to try as much as I can to continue to convince educators. I mean, it's really kind of sad that I have to be on a soapbox platform trying to convince educators of the importance of mental health and the importance of early identification and intervention. And this is why, and I don't know whether there's anybody from East Hampton High School, you know, who's listening right now. There's a great, great principal, Sarah Smith, a wonderful, wonderful superintendent, Adam Fine. He got it when I met with him a couple of, actually about a year and a half ago. I didn't have to do a selling job. He understood. The principal understood. The vice principal understood that these are our treasures. These are our treasures. And what I am seeing more and more and more with social media, and even talking with the students at the high school and in various other venues as well, there is a disconnect. I don't think that the pandemic, It didn't cause all the problems in the world. But the kids, and if you look around, in fact, I was on a subway in New York City. I actually live in New York City, half time in New York City, half time in East Hampton. And I was on the subway very, very recently and just kind of checking out what people were doing. And, you know, were they talking? Were they walking around the subway? And I would say that 99% of everybody was on their phone. And you know, there's nothing wrong with technology. We've embraced technology, but I think what's happened is that instead of, and this is what I've been encouraging people to do over and over and over again, that if it is at all possible, meet up with people face to face. I mean, if we're looking at what's going on in the online dating world, I mean, I've had patients where they have been online, they have in quotes connected with someone or maybe some people, you know, online, and there has been resistance to actually figure out and find out what the reality of this so-called or seeming relationship is by actually meeting face-to-face. And I think I've told the story previously where a woman who I was treating for depression, she was very excited, very, very excited. And I think that was the one thing in her life that was making her very excited, that she met this man online. And so I was asking her, so what is he like and what does he do? And is there a chemical sexual attraction? And what I discovered was that she was sexting and texting. They were sexting and texting for almost a year and they had never met. It was like, really? Really? You're sexting and texting for 1 year and you never met? And they also apparently did not have very many actual Zoom, telephone, face-to-face kinds of interactions. So I like to give people homework because I think that there is a goal and a mission and we need to figure out what things need to be done, what actions need to be actually taken if people are ever going to reach their goals, whatever those goals happen to be. So I had given her some homework and I said, listen, I think it's time. You've been, you know, doing this for a year. And if you've heard the story before, I'm going to repeat it again. What do you think happened? Well, they met and they never saw each other again. So that if you are going to be wanting to reach out, if you're going to be wanting, if you're in, for example, the singles dating scene, and everybody that I know, all my friends, all my patients, everybody, of course, is online and they are trying the dating sites. And what was really, really interesting and a little bit depressing, I treat a couple of young men who are in Chicago, and they too are online and very disappointed, very frustrated that they haven't really found the one and that they rarely get any matches at all. So we decided that we were going to just check out Chicago, big, big, big city. What kinds of in-person activities were available for singles in, let's say, between 25 and 35? So what we found was that there was not a lot going on. So we're going to be digging a little bit more. And yet you can, you know, think about if you're religious, you can go to churches or synagogues or book signings. I mean, there are so many different events, regardless of where you're living in the United States or any place else in the world. And it's really about, I think, this is just some self-motivation to say, look, I have a goal. And if your goal is that you really want to meet someone, then you're going to have to do more than just sit in your pajamas and sit online and look at your phone and basically not get yourself out there. And I know that we became very, very, very much out of practice. I mean, I'll share with you that my New York City practice used to be a very, very busy in-person practice. Well, these days, since the pandemic, I would say that 80% of my patients don't want to come in and work with me face to face. They prefer to Zoom, and it's not because they're worried about COVID. In fact, I have a patient, and you know, it's really kind of hard to believe, and I keep trying to encourage her to please, please come in. She lives one block away from me, and in New York City, my office happens to be in our apartment. So here's this woman, one block away, she will not. It's not that she has physical problems or medical problems or there's no reason. There's absolutely no reason at all why she won't come in, but she prefers to Zoom. So I think that we've become a little lazy, or maybe a really a lot lazy. And when I think about actually even doing the Ask Speedy Show, and I love the producers at the Progressive Radio Network. They make my life very, very, very easy. I haven't been into the studio since February, And the reason why I actually wanted to go into the studio, I wanted to meet some of the new producers. And I had a guest, Dr. Andrew Solomon, who I was just dying to meet in person. And I remember the weather was cold and it was rainy, and he took an Uber and I took the subway. And it was great. We had a great interview, which of course you can find on the Progressive Radio Network in the archives, the SPD archives. And I was so glad that I went. Yes, we could have Zoomed, and the producers would have been able to arrange for the interview to go on, and I'm sure it would have been okay. But it was just so nice. It was so nice, especially meeting Dr. Solomon, who is an amazing person, an amazing writer and psychologist. And of course, his area of specialization has been talking about teen depression and suicide. And if we're looking at depression and suicide in terms of what's going on in the world of teenagers, it's very, 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 very concerning. I mean, the statistics, and for those of you who've been listening to the show, you probably, heard me talk about the statistics. I mean, for example, and it's so hard to believe, it just sort of blows my mind that suicide was the second leading cause of death for kids ages 13 to 19, and the leading, listen to this, the leading cause of death amongst 13-year-old children. So what's going on? Now, I would be not at all surprised if these kids who ended up, unfortunately, committing suicide, I'm sure that they were exhibiting different kinds of symptoms, that there were certain sorts of behavior. If we had opened up our eyes, and this is not about blaming anybody. I remember when I was working in the schools in Montreal, it was the kid who didn't talk. You just sort of let them, kind of let them be. They weren't causing any trouble. There was no disruptions of any kind. But it's all the kids. It's not just the kids that are acting out and are looking for attention and have their own inner demons that get them to a place where they are behaving in ways that are, less than stellar. But it's also the kids who are quiet, who are shy, who don't talk, who won't look at you, who are not able or not willing to have conversations. These are the kids that we see in the education world every single day, so that we have an opportunity. And that's the thing that is so exciting for me about being a part of East Hampton High School. I mean, I'm only there one day a week, so it's not a lot of time. And I am not working with the students individually. I am not counseling them individually. I'm talking about other issues, relationships and sexuality and a lot of other mental health topics that I am discussing with them, along with their their new health teacher, who I am going to hopefully be meeting in a couple of weeks. But again, parents, for those of you who are parents, for those of you who are grandparents, maybe you need to take a second look at your child who doesn't want to go out and who isn't socializing and who's on their phone or on their computer all the time. And the same thing goes for the teachers, where the student may be doing very well academically, but you have a sense, and I know everybody's busy and there are a lot of students and there's a lot of work to do if you're in the world of academia, but maybe that we should open up our eyes a little wider and go back for a second look or a third look. And I've always felt, better to err on the side of caution, so that if there you have that feeling that something is just not right, to be willing. And sometimes it's a little risky, it's a little scary, you don't want to be intrusive, about just reaching out and asking, how are things going? You want to talk about something. And these kinds of chit-chat kinds of conversations can make all the difference in the world. Which takes me to, of course, my regular weekly segment, which is, how are you really doing? How are you really doing? And people will say, well, why do you have the same segment every single week? Well, because the questions that I am posing and to you are questions. These are central questions that can actually make or break our lives in all kinds of ways. So here we go again. So if we're looking at your mental health, my friends, how are you doing? How are you actually doing? Are you finding that the depression and the anxiety is worsening? Are you finding that the depression and anxiety or the eating disorder or substance abuse problem is really kind of taking over your life? And if you are willing to be honest with yourself. And I was having this conversation this morning with someone about the importance of our all being willing to be truthful, to not lie to ourselves, to be willing to really talk the truth, even if the truth is frightening and scary and depressing and challenging. So again, if you're finding that things are not going well in terms of your mental health, again, my question to you, my friends, is what are you going to do about this? I mean, for 10 years, when Gary Null and I first met, and this was 10 years ago, I'll never forget, we met at the Progressive Radio Network studio. And at that time, it was on the Upper West Side in New York. And we had talked about the show being a call-in counseling radio talk show because I had hosted a number of ASBD call-in counseling radio talk shows on major networks. So that was what I was hoping. And I think that probably Gary and I, we were really hoping that we could get the momentum going with this show where people would actually be calling in. So every week, and I'm still not giving up, of course, the number is 888-874-4888. And don't be shy. And no question is too stupid or too unimportant. And we all have, you know, questions about our relationships, about our mental health, about our physical health. And what I found really interesting, and we've not really been able to figure out why, is that we've received, frankly, over the years, very, very, very few on-air calls. Now, having said that, I actually receive emails from people, and a number of people over the years have actually called, and they've come in for counseling. But maybe it's the fact that the show is live at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm not exactly sure why. And maybe if you're listening right now, you could give me some insight. We could give the producers some insight as to what would it actually take, other than a lot of encouragement from me, to really motivate and inspire you to pick up the phone and and make a call. Again, that we all have questions about so many different things in our lives. Lives are changing. Things are so different today than they were 5, 10, 20 years ago. So again, can't change what's happened in the past, but if there's anything on your mind, and also if you agree or disagree or you want to debate me on any issue, I am so much welcoming this kind of discourse, this kind of dialogue. So in my How Are You Doing segment, again, of course, asking you about your mental health and what about your relationships? How are things really going in your relationship life? And it's not just your romantic relationship life if you happen to be in a romantic relationship. With your family, with your young children, with your adult children, with your colleagues. Relationships are complicated. Again, there are always so many ups and downs. But if you have anything that is on your mind, again, the number is 888-874-4888. And what about what's going on in your professional life? I'm hearing more and more people of all ages really, really concerned about their jobs. In fact, I'm treating a young 25-year-old man who really thought he got his degree, everything was set. And we were talking last week that he is very, very concerned that his department is going to be downsized. And what I suggested to him, I said, look, don't wait. I suggested that he contact a career counselor and really look at his strengths, look at his interests. And this is someone, excuse me, very, very interestingly, who ended up in the business slash tech world. And in talking with him, he was able to tell me that this was not at all the field that he was really interested in going into. So I said to him, I said, John, so how did this all happen? And he said that, well, his father is in business and tech. His stepfather is also a business person who's in the financial sector, and that he felt, and these were his words, so interesting that he was going to be disappointing his father and mother and stepfather if he did not follow in their footsteps. So I said to him, I said, John, so tell me, what do you really want to be doing? And he said, you know what? I think I'd like to be a teacher. And then he quickly said, but teachers don't make that much money, and I may not be able to have the kind of lifestyle. So his homework last week, and I will be talking to him in a couple of days, was actually to reach out to kind of an executive, you know, consulting firm, executive, well, coach, where he could actually take a very, very in-depth look at interests and also be able to take a look at the job market. Because, as I say, he's very concerned that he may be out of a job within a very, very short period of time. So whether or not it's your relationship or your mental health or your work, if you're finding that things are not working, we have to be willing and open to check out options. There's not just one person who is going to make you happy. And if this relationship doesn't work, that means that it's going to be the end of the world. I mean, things have changed. I know that, again, when I was a little girl, people had one job. You didn't go from job to job and then people would retire. I remember my grandfather, then you get a gold watch and that's it. Well, it's not like that anymore at all. People have multiple jobs throughout their lifetime. And if you're finding in evaluating, am I in the field? Am I in the job that's really working for me? And if you are, it's great. It's great that you found your passion. And frankly, you know, I feel so lucky that I, you know, I never think of my work, not the shows, not TV, not my counseling, not my writing, as work. And I was one of the lucky ones who was able very, very, very early on to find my passion and, you know, have been able to make, you know, a living doing what I actually love. But if you're finding that it's not working for you, again, that's not be leery about exploring other options, as my patient hopefully has done in this past week, because that was his homework assignment. And if you're looking again at your physical health, and again, it's about being honest with yourself. Are you living your life in ways that are in your best interest, whether we're talking about our mental health or our physical health or our relationships or our work life? Are we taking care of ourselves? Are we really taking care of ourselves? I mean, people talk about self-care all the time, but what does that mean to you in very, very, very concrete kinds of ways? And, you know, I haven't talked much about sexual orientation and gender, but again, it's a good thing that we are talking about all of this more now than ever before. And, you know, years and years ago, I remember working with two people who were going through, the whole transgender process. One was a man who was in the process of becoming a woman, and the other was a young woman who was in the process of becoming a man. And the young woman was young. She was really, really young. She was in her 20s, where the man who was in the process of becoming a woman was in his 50s. So he had lived his life feeling for years and years and years, probably from the time he was a little boy, a young boy, that he was living in the body of the wrong sex. So the young woman who was going through the process of becoming a man, she had a head start, and she was excited, and she was really fortunate that she had her family behind her. Whereas the man who was becoming a woman, his family wanted absolutely nothing to do with him again. So again, it's about checking all the boxes every single week, at least here on the Ask Beattie Show, and being honest with yourself. And if things are off, if things, whether we're talking mental health or relationships or your jobs or your sexual orientation or your self-care, or your sex life, it's always about trying to figure out what to do. Problem solution. And you know, again, for those of you who've been listening to me, you hear me say I've come up with a number of different, you know, phrases, Beattie kinds of phrases. I think my most favorite one is be willing to be honest with yourself and be willing to acknowledge, address, and resolve as best as we can, even though we can't change our history, the things that continue to play havoc with our lives and our relationships. And again, if I've convinced you of nothing, of absolutely nothing today or over all these years, please remember that you don't need to navigate the stressors and the ups and downs of life on your own. So I hope that my motivational pieces every single week actually will motivate you to really, and for many of you, to begin to do some of the things that you need to do that are really in your best interest. Well, last night, my husband, Jim, and I, and I've talked about Jim a lot. He's been a guest on my show. He is a sociologist and criminologist, and he's the host of a really amazing television show, The Radical Imagination, on MNN, and it plays on multiple different channels here in New York City. And we went to a very interesting documentary last night in East Hampton. The documentary was I Am Noise, and it was about Joan Baez's life. And she was there. It was incredible. It was a very long documentary. And at the end, there she was. And we were able to talk with her and ask her questions. So why am I bringing this up? Well, this documentary had to do with multiple skeletons in Joan Baez's closet, including sexual abuse. And there was some talk about multiple personality disorder and severe depression and anxiety and substance abuse. And my takeaway, of course, they talked about much more than just, you know, mental health issues and toxic family dynamics. And I mean, she had an amazing career. And I mean, for those of us who grew up in the 60s, I mean, Joan Baez, we loved her music. We loved her. We loved her stances on what was going on in the country, the choices that she was making. But what was really important for me, my takeaway, and that's one of the, I guess, occupational hazards of being a psychotherapist and sex therapist. You don't exactly just forget, you know, who you are and what you do 5 or 6 days a week, you know, when you are out and about. But this was a reminder about how our skeletons in the closet are unfinished business, whether it is with our family, whether it is with our friends, whether it is with ourselves, can really, really play havoc with your life. And in her documentary, in Joan Baez's documentary, she was so honest. She was talking about her family, grew up in a Quaker family. Seemingly on the surface, things were well. Her parents were together. Her father was a physicist. Her mother was loving and available for her and her two sisters. And yet, apparently, behind closed doors, there were a lot of other things going on. And Joan talked about her struggles over the years, the depression, the anxiety, not feeling good about herself, feeling afraid, and the list of very, very clear clinical symptoms went on and on. And she had talked about also that she had been in therapy from the time that she was a little girl. And I guess I was wondering what happened with her therapy and her various different therapists, that the disclosure of sexual abuse did not come very, very, very late in Joan Baez's life. Again, not blaming the therapist, not pointing fingers. All I know is that when I see people, and I have treated hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who have been sexually abused, and one has to be very, very cautious when you're trying to figure out whether or not it's sexual abuse or whether or not, you know, whatever it is that may be going on in somebody's life. We have to be very careful. We have to be willing and able and competent to do extraordinarily in-depth, you know, psychiatric kinds of evaluations. So, I mean, the psychiatric part of this documentary, I mean, it was, you know, mentioned throughout. But I guess I was wondering, you know, why it was that it took, well, basically most of Joan's life for the sexual abuse allegations to be uncovered. And again, she talked, you know, without going into a lot of detail, about just not being ready. And yet she suffered, like so many of my patients have, for so long, with unexplained symptoms. You know, what was it about what was going on or not going on in their lives, where they couldn't have healthy relationships, where they had problems sexually, where they ended up in crazy kinds of relationships that basically mirrored the kinds of relationships that they had with their own family of origin growing up. So again, our unfinished business. It's very, very easy to say, oh, well, that happened 20 years ago, or that happened 50 years ago. But I believe, and I know therapists work in all kinds of different ways, but I believe when I see patients, when I begin my therapy process with people, I always begin at the beginning. I want to know everything that happened and everything that did not happen from the time that the person was a young boy or a young little girl that may help. Now, not all the people that I treat have early trauma. I mean, that is for sure. But I would say that a very, very, very high percentage of people that I have worked with over all of these years did have early trauma of various different kinds growing up in their own family of origin. Now, people might say, well, hey, it happened. It happened a long time ago. You got to get over it. You got to move forward. It's true. You do have to move forward. And there are things that people need to do. It's not a question of getting over it. It's a question, and this is something, and it would be interesting to maybe have a conversation with another therapist who perhaps works in another kind of way than I do. But to be able to go back and really trace as early on as possible when the child, let's assume the child had symptoms early on, just as Joan Baez did, to try to get to the bottom of what is it that is really going on in this family. Now, regardless if somebody is dealing with trauma that happened 50 years ago or you know, two weeks ago or a week ago, again, it's about providing people with a very, very safe space where you are then able to help them, not to forget the trauma, but to help them to be able to emotionally work through what did and didn't happen that caused them the kind of depression, the kind of anxiety, the kind of stress, the kind of suicidal thoughts, the kind of suicidal ideation that they may be having. And it is a process. And I must say that it is not a fun process. It is a very, very difficult and painful process. And yet, because I've treated so many hundreds and hundreds of people who've been sexually abused as children and who've had a variety of different kinds of traumas that they have had to try to deal with, I'm very, very familiar with a process that typically tends to work. So it's not just about staying in the moment and dealing with the present. It is about helping the person in the best possible way, even though we can't change anything that happened a second ago, to be able to process what happened that would explain and validate their concerns and their worries and their avoidance and their depression and their substance abuse, to be able to then help them get to another place, a better place in their lives. And as therapists, of course, I have strong biases. I have strong biases that sessions should be 60 minutes and not 45 minutes or 50 minutes. Again, this is my Canadian upbringing. An hour is 60 minutes. It's not 45 minutes and it's not 50 minutes. And I also have a strong bias, and it's been proven to be extremely effective with people that I work with who present with a variety of different kinds of problems, that if people are able to have longer sessions, I mean, I've had sessions with people that have lasted 4 and 5 hours, 4 and 5 consecutive hours, when the people didn't even want to take a bathroom break because we were so engaged in doing what we needed to do. So what's the point? The point that I'm trying to really make is whether or not we're talking about new problems, old problems, new trauma, old trauma, even though we cannot change, unfortunately, anything that happened or didn't happen to us in our history or in our present. The good news is that with the right kind of help, You are going to be able to work through as best as you can these issues that have possibly interfered with the quality of your life for years and years and years. And Joan Baez, it's amazing. I mean, that she was able to have such an incredible career. But behind closed doors, Joan was really, really, really suffering. And again, I'm not sure. I'm so curious. I would love to have been able to have an opportunity to really talk with her privately. And there were so many people who were wanting to talk with her that I didn't have that opportunity. And to be able to maybe dig a little bit deep with her as to what happened all those years when she was in therapy, because she, you know, said it over and over again that she had been in therapy for most of her life. And yet it was only much, much, much later in life that, these are her terminology, expressions, that it was uncovered that there had been sexual abuse, which, by the way, both of her parents denied. Both of her parents, of course, are no longer alive. And she believed, and she said this in the question and answer after the documentary, that she believes that her parents did not remember, in quotes, what happened. So again, in dealing with this issue for so many years, I would have a lot of questions for Joan Baez and for any of you who have unfortunately been victims of sexual abuse or any other kind of trauma. But there is hope, there is treatment, there is effective treatment that can help you move forward regardless of what happened in your early life or in your current life as well. Of course, it's always a challenge, right, to find the right doctor, the right lawyer, the right dentist, the right lipstick, right? It's a challenge. But I don't want people to leave this show thinking that there is no hope. There is hope. And again, we don't need to try to do this on our own. Well, how is it possible that it's 3:56 here in New York City? It's hot. It's humid. I was on the tennis courts this morning. I think the humidity felt like it was almost 100%. It was very difficult, but that was my need for my mental health beginning every single, I play a number of times during the week, but on Mondays, because of this show, this is a really wonderful way for me to start the day. It loosens me up and I feel a lot just more confident and looser with that kind of vigorous exercise. So, okay, everyone, it is 3:57 and I want to leave you with my two weekly messages. And of course, the first is the same message that I have been trying to communicate to you for years, and that is to make sure that you are doing everything that you can possibly do. And you got to be mindful and ask yourself the question, is this good for me? To be mindful of the importance of living your life in ways that are truly, truly in your best interest, not in the best interest of your father or mother or grandfather or sibling or partner, but being honest with yourself. And if not, of course, then what are you going to do about it? And there are a lot of things that we can do to improve the quality of our lives and the quality of our relationships. And of course, the second very, very important takeaway is that we all need to do a much, 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 much better job in learning to love each other, to accept each other, differences and all. So again, I hope that this show was inspirational and motivational. I hope all the shows are inspirational and motivational. Again, you have my contact information, bdcode.com, and I wish you a really, really good and happy and joyful rest of the day. And I look forward to speaking with you next Monday and every Monday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern. Let's do a better job in loving each other, and I'll talk with you next week. Bye-bye, everybody.
I need somebody. Help. not just anybody. You know I need someone. When I was younger, so much younger than today.